The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to professional investor and ex-fund manager Graham Neary of Stockopedia. So welcome, Graham. Welcome, Graham.
Yeah, thanks very much, Paul. Thank you for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Sorry, I didn't realise it was a bit late. We've got quite a few sort of cross currents in the market at the moment. We've had, obviously, the ongoing war in Ukraine. We've had now the Middle Eastern crisis offset by inflation coming down. And now, you know, investors are baking in interest rate cuts. So putting all that into the mix, what's your sort of like outlook for equities for the rest of the year, particularly your sort of sweet spot of small and mid caps?
Yeah, well, thanks for the question. I mean, most of that stuff to me is not hugely relevant. A lot of it is noise. You know, I love those charts people put on Twitter where they show a long-term equity chart and they show this war, this problem, that problem. And then if you zoom out, then actually everything's fine. So long-term, my outlook is same as ever, positive. Short term, I suppose the question is whether we will get the rate cuts that have been promised or hinted at. Inflation does seem to be a little bit sticky. It's not really, it's sort of stopped falling, I think, in the last few periods. So there is that question mark over whether inflation will fall sufficiently to allow rate cuts that are desired. But I think it does seem as if the tightening cycle is over. So from that point of view, a lot of the sensitive cyclical stocks are looking quite good, I would say. And you know, because I find the financials interesting, and I do like sectors sometimes that are tied to economic waves. Obviously, it'd be quite good to see those rate cuts happen, but I would never invest on something purely on that hope.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I mean, we all hope, obviously, that we will get a bit of a cyclical swing later on in the year. But before we sort of go through some stocks, and I did notice on, you know, the ones we're going to talk about, there's a lot of sort of really good value and sort of like one or two sort of really good growth ones as well. So, but before we go into that and dig into the details, I don't suppose you could just quickly sort of like, you know, let us know what type of investor is Graham Neary? Is he a sort of value investor, a fundamentals chartist, sort of like, or is he a growth, or how would you sort of best sum yourself up?
Well, it's a lovely question, Paul. Everybody likes talking about themselves, you know, but I mean, look, I wear different hats. I'm, you know, I have my own portfolio, which is fairly boring. I've got, as I said, Berkshire Hathaway. I've got some big caps. I've got, a couple of selected small caps. And then as an analyst, then, you know, for Stockopedia, I get to write about everything all day, and I get to throw out a lot of ideas that I may not have the time or the spare capacity in my portfolio to invest in at the time. But I get to just throw everything out there as an analyst and say, these are my best ideas. Mm. But I'm definitely in the fundamental camp. But believe it or not, Paul, I used to be a technical analyst by trade.
Oh, right.
Yeah, not many people know that, although
the art of voodoo.
Yeah. So Ichimoku clouds and all that. So I do. But one thing that technical analysts appreciate that fundamentalists don't is that, you know, markets often go much further than anybody expects to the upside and the downside. So that sort of opened my eyes to the fact that, you know, you can have a very pretty fundamental thesis. But then if it's got a blind spot, well, then the stock could end up going much lower than you thought or much higher than you thought. Mm-hmm. And it's impossible to tell in advance, you know, when you have a blind spot, which of course we all have our blind spots and we try to work on them. But I'm now in the fundamental camp, but I do think there is something to momentum. I think momentum is real. It does exist.
Yeah, I guess the idea is to sort of like pick on a fundamental basis and then run with the momentum, particularly if it's moving in your direction. Now, just let's move to a couple of sort of like, you know, the stocks. One in particular in this area, one of your area of expertise, which is the small cap UK brokers. And we've got two here. We've got Cavendish, which I think was formerly Cenkos and Fincap, and then we've also got Peel Hunt, which is more of a sort of like a specialist boutique sort of investment house. So let's kick off with Cavendish. What's your sort of the attraction there? It does seem as though it's extremely lowly valued and not much needs to go right for the investment to work here, I guess.
Yeah, so this is one that has been obviously on my radar for a while. I'm sure you're very familiar with it as well. Cavendish being the merger of Cenkos and Fincap. And you know, I thought that both of those as standalone investments were quite interesting. You know, as being brokerage houses, they had very strong balance sheets. And with the absolute famine in the you know, the IPO market, these things had fallen dramatically, their share prices. And then they merged. And so now we've got a theme which I'm always interested in is competition. Competition in the market is that little bit weaker now because the two companies aren't competing with each other anymore. So the combination is the number one AIM broker. And then along with that, you've got the economies of scale. So they claim to have unlocked £7 million of cost synergies, which may not sound like a lot, but when your market cap is only around £40 million and your enterprise value is only 20 something million pounds, £7 million of cost synergies seems pretty significant. So you know, I think that if you do believe we will get another bull market and we'll get a rush of IPOs and fundraisings, you know, at some point in the next few years, then you know, Cavendish, I'd say, is very well placed.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think with a rock solid balance sheet and it's got trough earnings and trades at about 11 times, just under 11 times PE, you've baked in the worst case there, haven't you? And so it's going to, you should hope there will be only upside if the markets do recover.
Because obviously, this year and next year's earnings are not reflective of what it could do, you know, in a bull market, which we've seen it before. As you know, Paul, you have your stripes, you know, we've been through this before. These things come and go. So,
Scars, scars.
yeah.
What about Peel Hunt? It's slightly bigger. It's 140 million market cap, and it really is sort of like more of a sort of. It's more of it's more of an institutional type broker. I think it has further more recurring revenue streams as well through its trading part. More of a specialist boutique. What's your sort of like the investment similar investment case for Peel Hunt, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar. As you say, it is bigger. I think Peel Hunt's research is very, very highly regarded. I mean, not to say that anybody else's research isn't, but I think Peel Hunt is really considered, you know, excellent, best in class almost research for its sector. I mean, this is still a fairly low market cap company, but it is bigger than Cavendish. And I suppose the other point is there's a, maybe a little bit less familiarity with this one in the public markets because it didn't IPO until I think 2021, possibly. It was only in the last few years that it IPO'd. So it still kind of has a bit to prove as a publicly listed stock, but you know, it is down by more than 50% from its IPO price. Obviously, it IPO'd when things were looking a lot better, but you know, it is. I would say that this is basically the same investment thesis as Cavendish. Very solid asset backing and good potential for recovery.
Yeah, what's the chances it was going to get bought out? Because Numis wasn't it, by Deutsche Bank, I think, about a year ago. And you also had. Was it there was Panmure Gordon and somebody else got together as well? So there's a lot of M&A in this area, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, look, My 2023 best ideas list did extremely well, but there's obviously a lot of luck in that when you're picking your 10 best ideas. You know, picking one stock over another is very difficult, and you know, it can make a big difference. So I actually had Numis in my 2023 list, and that went up, I think, the best part of 80% as a result of that takeover from Deutsche. So obviously, you know, it would make my performance look brilliant if we had a few more of these takeovers. And obviously, I think that they're justified. Otherwise, I wouldn't be picking the stocks. You know, to me, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, you're too modest there, Graham. I call it skill, but hey ho, to play the odds that one. Now let's move to another sector. There's a lot of consolidation going on in the fund manager area, and this is brilliant because I'm actually interviewing a fund manager talking about the fund manager sector. We've got quite a few here which are really trading at rock bottom level. We've got Ashmore, Jupiter, we've got Mercia, and also Polar Capital. So let's kick off with the emerging markets guy, Ashmore. We think came out with a statement just the last couple of days. It's quite big, actually. I think its market cap is about 1.6 billion. It trades quite a rich price, actually. I think it's about just 1.8 times EV stroke AUM. So what's your sort of view on this one? Are we going to see the rebirth of emerging market investing?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've always been bullish on this one, nearly always. So maybe I'm a bit of a perma bull, but I do agree with Mark Coombs on this one. You know, he's the CEO and the founder, and he's always talking up emerging markets. But I tend to think that he's right. I think there's good value in emerging markets. I think that developed markets are, you know, very, very expensive by comparison. But obviously, the institutional investors who have to allocate the big money, they don't really agree, and they have been taking money out of Ashmore. But you know, one of the recurring themes in this sector, which I find fascinating, is that in a lot of cases, AUM is not falling by much or even at all, because with these fund managers, even with investors taking money out, you still get positive market returns a lot of the time, which can offset the outflows. So in the case of Ashmore, it has suffered, you know, £1 billion of outflows, but you know, the AUM is still £54 billion. It's still, you know, an enormously significant fund manager. It has a specialism which I really like in emerging market fixed income, although it's also diversifying into equity. But basically, Paul, I think that this is a very nicely specialized fund manager trading at a very nice valuation. It is very, very profitable, and its balance sheet is extraordinary. You know, it has, I think, about £300 million of seed capital investments. So you can knock that off the market cap for your EV calculation. £450 million of cash. Just an enormously strong and substantial business, I think, at a nice valuation.
Yeah, and I think again, a lot of people, big fund managers in this consolidating, will be looking at it as a bit of a crown jewel in emerging markets because it's a place that they want to go to defend themselves against the passives and ETFs, isn't it? So I think you're right. One company that's been a perennial sort of like going down to the left, down to the bottom, has been Jupiter, and I think it lost one of its sort of like rock star fund managers the other days. What's the sort of investment thesis here? Is this a sort of a mean reversion trade that things can only get better?
Yeah, I mean, look, if I had included this in my list would not have done nearly as well, because this one has been going down and to the right
Yeah.
for a long time. You know, the fund management space is fascinating because they all seem to look cheap, but then if you're trying to like pick what is the best one in the sector, the issue with Jupiter is the lack of differentiation. So you were talking about Ashmore.
Yeah.
Other fund managers want to defend themselves by having that niche in emerging markets. And then you say, well, what is Jupiter's niche? and it's not very easy to sort of articulate or figure it out. And I think that's the real problem. But I've been bullish on this one wrongly because they've had a new CEO. I think they had a buyback, a share buyback, and they're streamlining their funds to simplify. And now, but they have this problem now, as you mentioned, that a fund manager's left and he actually wants to set up his own business in due course, his own fund management business. So it is a tricky one. Jupiter is probably, you know, one of the least differentiated fund managers, and that's its major issue. But if you like cheap shares, I mean, the valuation is absurdly cheap. Yeah. So there you go. It's I suppose you have to take a choice.
Yeah, no, I mean, looking on a sort of EV to AUM, it trades at about 0.8, so it's less than half of what Ashmore is. So, yeah, it is extreme. Maybe actually, Graham, there's a job opportunity there for you. Actually, you can turn around. What about that? I don't think Stockopedia will be too happy, though. So I'm going to turn to Mercia Tech, which is more of a small cap sort of like regional investment house. I think probably it does quite a few, I don't know, you get me right, probably private type of investments, which have means it's got long-term capital and therefore is very sticky and so can see visibility of its fees rather than having open-ended funds, etc. What's a sort of like the beauty of Mercia Asset Management?
I mean, look, this is a difficult one to unlock. It's not your typical fund manager. But they do have a niche. Their niche is buying small and medium-sized enterprises around the regions of the UK, so basically outside London. I suppose there's a little clue in the name of the company that they're Mercia. Outside London. Exactly. So I think that is a niche that should have some value because, you know, the fund managers are probably a little bit too London focused. So maybe it's good to have somebody outside London looking for opportunities, you know, around the UK. So for me, this is just a very plain old value investment. You know, they had net assets 50% above the share price. They actually sold one of their portfolio investments, and they ended up with £60 million on the market cap at the time I was looking at it was about £130 million. So just a plain old value share. And they're trying to build their third-party fund management business now, and they might be putting some of their cash to use now on the little, if they can find some bolt-on acquisitions, you know, in the space. So, I mean, look, it's maybe a little bit speculative in the sense that they don't have a big fund management business yet, but I do think it's a value investment, and I think it's a nice idea. It's an interesting niche that they're working on.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's got a net asset value of roughly around about 45p, and it trades at just under 30. So, yeah, plenty of upside. It's quite interesting, actually, because I think it's a similar sort of thing as Gresham House, which was just recently bought by a US venture capitalist guy, and they went for quite a high multiple, but it's locked in capital with the manage. And so I think Mercia is similar. So it can go at a very high price, these things. Okay, let's move to the last one, which is Polar Capital. Well, I know Christopher Mills, you're in a good company here, also invest with them. It's a sort of tech and life science specialist fund manager. Can you take us through this one?
Yeah, so, I mean, basically the story with Polar is that they kind of do sit in the traditional or conventional fund manager space, but they have sort of, I would say, a decent franchise in technology and in healthcare. So they're kind of known for being particularly good in those sectors. And I think that's what you've got to look for in a fund manager is like, what are they really good at? Now, if you look at, you know, they've had an AUM update this month, which showed, again, negative flows, but AUM rising to more than fully offset that. So, you know, I think that's, you know, when you see valuations falling, but AUM is actually rising, then I think that's a nice story. Overall, I mean, I've decided to put that in my 2024 best ideas list just because if you're trying to find a fault in a fund manager, I actually haven't been able to find anything wrong with Polar in my studies of it. So it is more highly rated than its peers, but sometimes I think it's okay to pay up a little bit for quality.
Well, I mean, it's only on a PE of 12, so it just tells you how re-rated the whole section is, or down-rated. One feature of all the six stocks we've just talked about is rock-solid balance sheets. I've just noticed every single one has got it's got a real heap of cash on. Is that sort of like something you look for?
You know, Paul, it's not deliberate, but maybe
You're being
it
modest
just
again, aren't
happens.
you?
No, it's not deliberate. Maybe it just happens. You know, maybe when I see a company with net debt, I just get the shivers. But it's not. I'm not trying to make this a pattern. No.
Okay, well, just by coincidence, then there's another one with spread better, CMC Markets, and you and Paul Scott have knocked the ball out of the park with your predictions so far for 2024, because you both put this on your list, I believe. And this one's a sort of like your classic sort of beaten down spread better CFD provider. Came out with a, first of all, a positive trading update at the start of the year, and then a sort of cost cutting exercise, I think. It's sort of like a double boost. Take us through your latest view on this, because you must have done pretty well so far, and it's only 5 weeks into the year.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's been remarkable 5 weeks for CMC. Now, I don't own CMC myself. I own IG Group. It's our larger competitor. That's the company I'm a shareholder in. But obviously, I've been tracking, I track both companies. And I put CMC in my lists because I just thought, the market doesn't like the fact that it's loss making, which is fair enough. But then, the key feature here, and I feel like I've said this a million times now, is operational leverage. Operational leverage at CMC is extraordinary. Fixed costs, or largely fixed costs, and then incredible conversion of revenue into profits when people start trading. So they just need people to start using the platform more, and those revenues and net operating income will go straight through to profits. So, it's kind of just been at that cusp where, small differences and small improvements make a huge difference to performance. The most recent report was that basically they're cutting the workforce by about a sixth, I think. So a couple of hundred jobs going. Now, it's obviously very tough for the staff, but I think there were clues that something was going to happen. I think what happened is the market was just taken by surprise by the scale of the cost cuts. Lord Cruddas had signaled that the investment cycle had peaked. CMC's been rolling out new products over the last few years. It's required a lot of investment to sort of develop what they're doing. But they've kind of reached a point now where they can start cutting back on that expense, on that investment. So, I mean, I hoped and expected that they would control their costs. I didn't expect them to come up with these scale of job cuts, but it's transformational to profitability. It's tens of millions of pounds, 20 million pounds of savings. For a company with a market cap less than 400 million pounds and with an enterprise value much smaller than that, a 20 million pound cost saving is a big deal. And then all you need is revenues to go up a little bit, which I think they will, and you've got a totally different profit performance.
And I guess when opportunity knocks on one door, is there a read across for you and in IG Group at all? Is this totally idiosyncratic sort of case study, or is it actually something a bit of a beneficial for the industry? Because the cost savings can't, you wouldn't have thought, is just going to be, sort of related to this company.
Well, you see, I think the thing with CMC is they've had their own plans. They've been expanding in, I think, New Zealand. They've been building out new derivatives and option products. And being smaller, that means that their results are a lot more volatile than IG Group. You know, IG is kind of, because it's so big, it's already past that point of profitability where small changes don't make such a big difference to its results.
Okay, I'll take that as a no then, but I'll be optimistic myself. Now let's move to another sector, a bit more sort of like recession resilient. Well, definitely recession resilient. Let's see, soft drinks makers. We've got a couple here. Let's go for Iron Brew AJ Bar first of all. Do you want to take us through this one? Again, it's got another one that adds to a number. First of all, it got 50 million of net cash on the balance sheet, market cap of just over 600 million. What's the sort of the attractions here? Trades at about 15 times PE.
Yeah, so yeah, I've had this one on my best ideas list for 2 years running now. It didn't really do much last year, I don't think, but for, you know, in terms of share price. But the basic idea here, Paul, and I don't know if you'll agree with me, is that I think we will get a recovery in the soft drinks companies' margins. So during this inflationary period, there's been sort of two issues. I know you said there about maybe being recession-proof possibly, but they have had troubles with inflation driving up costs and then a little bit of weakness in consumer demand possibly as well. So I suppose the question is, can AG Bar get back, you know, to margins that it would have had before? You know, it used to have operating margins of, say, 17%, 16%. That's fallen now to 12%. So can inflation sort of feed through? Will customers accept higher prices? Volumes, I think, have been pretty weak. So it is a tough one, but basically, you know, if you're a student of Warren Buffett, you're going to, you know, it's natural to think, you know, is there a Coca-Cola around the UK that I can invest in? I don't think AG Bar is a Coca-Cola, but it's obviously, it's a soft drinks company that does have a very long history of being profitable and, you know, attractively profitable with very good quality metrics. So I'm sort of hoping that it can get back to former performance levels.
Yeah. What about Nichols, which owns Vimto? It has got EBIT margins of 15% rather than 12.5%. What was your view on that? Similar sort of argument, is it? Recovery.
Yeah. They've had some unprofitable contracts in what they call the out-of-home segment. So
what's that?
So basically people buying drinks in bars and pubs and just consuming there then and there. And basically that hasn't been very profitable, and they've been basically restructuring. So maybe in some ways it's a little bit more aggressive what they're trying to do compared to AG Bar. But you know, they performed reasonably well during COVID. Again, it's another net cash. And you know, it's a family business, which is another feature of stocks that, you know, a lot of people, you know, like to look out for. They've just had a new member of the Nichols family join the board as a non-exec. So, you know, it's a nice family business. It is a little bit expensive, perhaps on a PE multiple basis, but if margins recovered, then it wouldn't look so expensive at all. So that's the basic thesis.
Yeah. And also, I think if you stripped out the cash and did it on a sort of like a no cash basis, then the PE was, both of them were dropped by 10-15%. So yeah, I would agree. What's the sort of like chances of internationalizing these brands? Because they're obviously iconic in certain areas in the UK, and they've got a legion of people who will only drink Iron Brew and Vimto. I'm not one of them, but lots of people do. But taking it overseas, is there an international angle on that, or is it just a very much a sort of like a local taste?
I mean, I mean, you may be better placed to answer this than me, but I mean, I think there is interest. Maybe it is a little bit more expat interest, you know, rather than real foreign interest, if I can call it that. You know, interest from, you know, basically from the British populations abroad and people of British heritage abroad. I mean, you know, being Irish myself, I've been, you know, I'm a huge fan of Iron Brew. I drink Iron Brew whenever I see it, but unfortunately I don't see it that often in the shops. I think it's, I would say that both brands have been around long enough that maybe, you know, I wouldn't hold out hope of any major change there, anytime soon.
Yeah.
But I don't know what you think. Maybe you disagree.
No. Well, I mean, I don't think there shouldn't be any reason why they can't, you know, deploy some of the spare cash on the balance sheet. They've got a pretty stable business. And rather than just making, you know, get it clipping the interest, then maybe even invest in certain areas of growth, organic or abroad, because there's no reason why it can't become a Branston's pick, you know, type brand, or a Marmite, or even a Guinness. You know, you never know, does it? I mean, they're very peculiar, and they've got a lot of sort of like, you know, brand attractions. People love it, and you rightly say target expats first where it's easiest. Then, why not? Okay, good. Well, let's move on to another sort of, well, this one's a very cyclically resilient sector. In fact, very much counter-cyclical. We've got the pawnbrokers, H&T, which is the UK's largest pawnbroker. And then we've got Ramsdens, which is, I think, probably the second largest, but has actually got more of a retail and Forex angle. Let's look at H&T first. I think Pledge Book is going through the roof at the moment, which is not a surprise as people need its services. Both ends of the spectrum, because the FD had a report of a lot of wealthy people now are using pawnbrokers as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, I love this sector as an investment. And actually, you know, it gets a bit of a bad name. Sometimes people think there's something a little bit, you know, not quite right about the pawnbroking business. But I think, you know, as lenders go, I think it is one of the best, most ethical type of loans that you can make. There's no credit check needed. If the person defaults, there's no hit to the credit rating. Yes, the interest rates are high. You could be talking 9% a month or 10% a month or something. But you don't have to, you know, you can just walk away from the loan with no repercussions, you know, which is very different to, you know, virtually all other loans. And I think the regulators are very comfortable with pawnbroking. You know, after we saw payday loan companies get shut down, and we saw regulation, tighter regulation of pawnbroking, but it's still here, stronger than ever. Huge demand, obviously, over the last couple of years. As you say, the pledge book's gone through the roof. The issue with H&T is that I suppose expectations just got a little bit out of hand. So they did have a profit warning in January. But, you know, profits were in fact up by 40% compared to the previous year. So it's just expectations maybe got a little bit overheated. It's a massive pawnbroking book. And you've got that nice ability to retail items or to send them to, if it's gold, you can just sell the gold and have to get the gold value. So you've got the retailing side, you've got the FX holiday money side, you've got the gold purchasing side. So it's a bit of diversification and just a great business. I've been following it for over 10 years now.
Yeah, I can't understand why it's on a PE of less than 7 and pays a 4.5% dividend yield. And I'm with you in terms of, you know, sort of the view from the public, because it allows people, and you can be, you know, hard up or wealthy, to monetize assets that don't have any liquidity. So let's for instance, you've got a car and you can't, you know, you're going to sell it, and it'll, or you need your car, but you're effectively a pledge or a painting or a watch or something like that, and you can't sell it to get money because you'll take a huge haircut on it, and therefore you monetize it through a pawnbroker. So I'm with you. I think it's a service, isn't it? It's not throwing anything dirty, and it's there.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of loan that does the least harm to you if you can't pay it back. You know, I mean, obviously nobody wants to lose their family heirlooms, but there may be instances in life where where it's the there are worse possibilities than that. And you know, H&T, I would say, is a big responsible business that I would say treats people very fairly. They've been examined by the regulators like everybody else for years, and they've come out sparkling every time. So
Agree.
yeah, I don't see any ethical issues.
Yeah. What about Ramsden's? It trades at slightly higher, 8 times PE. I mean, it just seems as though this whole sector, given it's counter-cyclical, is extremely lowly rated at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Ramsden's is it's not really a pawnbroker, as such. They describe themselves as a diversified financial services provider, and I think that's a pretty fair description. The pawnbroking is only a relatively small part of it. I actually had a chance to interview management last month, and it's very nice of them to give me a chance to speak to them. And I came away feeling just as confident as I was before that they were doing things responsibly. They are expanding, and I did see a little bit of danger in that because traditionally a more northern-based business is setting up shop around the corner from places where H&T has been operating for maybe 100 years. I thought, well, let's see how this goes. But it seems as if there's enough demand. There's enough demand to satisfy both companies. And Ramsden's is being very responsible. I think that they're not opening up sort of 50 stores overnight. They're doing it incrementally, seeing how it goes. And so this is another highly profitable, cheap business. And I find it difficult to see issues, but that's just my view.
Well, I think it's probably another reflection, isn't it, of the market sort of underpricing a lot of small caps, and gives probably you, but certainly me, a bit of optimism going forward. I mean, it trades, as I say, it's just over 8 times PE and 5.5 times sort of dividend yield. I mean, just could you say a few words on sort of the small cap sector, because they haven't really benefited from the Santa rally, but it's been a bit flat the first couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of this thing where they're kind of most of them seem to be doing maybe not that much, and then you get the odd takeover that just goes up 50% or 100%, but it's hard, nobody can predict which one is going to experience that. So yeah, if you're not lucky enough to get a takeover, then you may be stuck with something that's not really moving very much. So yeah, it's, I mean, but if you're planning to hold these things for 5 years or so, then I don't think it really matters. But it is, I can understand, certainly there's frustration. I mean, I experience it myself, frustration. Things don't seem to be really moving when you think they should be.
Well, Berkshire Hathaway did well for you, I think, last year, so that's not so bad. Another one in this sort of the financial services area is Mortgage Advice Bureau, that is basically a housing a broker, not, I think, for people like self-employed or people who want buy-to-let type mortgages. And what was quite interesting, there was some I think it was the RICS survey this morning saying that it's for the first time in 2 years it's now starting to see more transactions, and particularly buyer interest in sort of homes and stuff like that. Can you take us through your latest on this one, on a Mortgage Advice Bureau? Because I guess it's probably we may have reached the bottom in this whole area.
Yeah, I mean, Mortgage Advice Bureau has actually did quite well in 2023. You know, its valuation, you know, did grow significantly. And I consider this to be a kind of unusual stock in the sense that it's high quality, in my opinion, but it's also economically geared. So let me explain. It's high quality in the sense that they have a franchise business model. So the authorized representatives take on quite a lot of risk, do a lot of work, and Mortgage Advice Bureau is kind of there in the background helping its representatives, but not having to do all of the work and take all of the risk, you know, in each particular location. So yeah, obviously the mortgage market is a hot topic. The way Mortgage Advice Bureau has been kind of making money has been, there's been a lot of remortgages and people switching rather than new mortgages. So new mortgage lending tends to be a lot more profitable. You get bigger margins on that. I guess the amounts are quite large, you know, compared to remortgages, and people who are remortgaging might be, you know, a little bit more price conscious, perhaps. I'm not sure, but basically, it's a capital light business. It is a little bit expensive now, probably, but you know, I would say holders should probably be feeling pretty happy with performance. Maybe it's not something that's worth initiating a new position today at the current price. You know, price has gone up a little bit. I'm not sure if you agree.
Yeah, I mean, it is trading at 24 times, but I'm guessing that's on trough earnings, isn't it? Because if the housing market does start to pick up, and I think somebody told me that transactions year on year or from the peak are down like 30-40%. So if you do start to see more new build being, because the housing builders are seeing it, and you start seeing more refinancing, admittedly on a lower margin, but even so, then you could easily see their profits double, which would bring bring it to really a, you know, very cheap valuation.
Yeah, no, there's definitely that possibility. I was very impressed with their performance in 2023. Really solid. You know, and if they can do that in an in such a terrible mortgage market, it does suggest that in a healthy mortgage market, they do very well indeed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move to another one. We've got the Property Franchise Group, which is into a merger now with almost like a 50-50 with Belvoir as well, which is another estate agent. And I'm guessing, I won't put your word, what is your sort of investment thesis on this one? Because it's trading at about 12 times forward earnings and not particularly expensive.
Sorry. Yeah. Excuse me. I would say this is kind of similar to Mortgage Advice Bureau. Obviously, they are similar businesses in the sense that they're both franchise business models, and they're both in property. But obviously, in this case, we're talking about estate agents. I've been a long-term fan of both businesses. So I was very interested to see that they decided to merge. It's a similar idea. If you are willing to bet on the property market, I think that these are quite high quality companies. Like, they've always had stunning cash conversion, stunning return on capital. The management seemed to be clued in, not taking extraordinary risks. One nice little feature of Property Franchise is owning this U-Move business, which is a sort of a hybrid estate agent. You know, I don't know if you remember all the talk about purple bricks, and
I know it badly. I know from my own pain, I lost a lot of money on purple bricks. It was taken out to the woodshed, and so did I.
Sorry to hear that. Sorry.
No, I'm not an expert in this area, but I could certainly imagine this merger doing what, you know, the similar principle as you've had before, which was taking out cost, taking out competition. And I know they've got sort of like the recurring revenue streams on the lettings business, haven't they?
They do, yeah. And they've got, you see, they've got different strengths as well. So Property Franchise has a hybrid estate agent, which Belvoir doesn't have. Belvoir is more, has more got going on in financial advice and mortgages, mortgage advisors, which Property Franchise doesn't have. So the merger means they obviously they get increased scale, increased strength. They're different points of strength can be combined. And yeah, I think it's pretty exciting. Both, as I said, both really high quality businesses joining forces. Yeah, I don't really see anything not to like here. And it's an all share merger. So there's no cash leaving either business.
Yeah, and you'll get that operational gearing if the housing market does pick up. There's no doubt about it. Okay, let's move to the final one, which actually is a bit of a sort of developer and house builder. It's Henry Boot, which a lot of people sort of forget. But we have had that sort of like blockbuster deal yesterday between Barratt's and Redrow. So that was about £7.5 billion, I think, pound. But what's your sort of your latest on Henry Boot? They did warn, I think, in terms of their debtors picked up because they were sort of like their creditors were being extended by the house builders on their property develop on their land development, I think.
Yeah, so I mean, look, this is a sector where I don't have, you know, I don't feel as comfortable, but I just noticed that Henry Boot seemed to be offering decent value to investors at the current level. Now, the problem was house builders seem to be having some delays, and therefore this is having some knock on to in terms of just paying Henry Boot for land, basically. So maybe there's certain milestones that haven't been met there, or whatever the reason is, they've been pushed back, and that's left Henry Boot with more debt than it wanted. But at the end of the day, it's still got a very decent NAV, I think over 300p.
Yeah.
So that's. Like my general approach to house builders or land developers or this whole space is there's kind of opportunities that get thrown up once in a while where you can buy them at a big discount to NAV and especially tangible NAV. And when that happens, I feel that kind of takes a lot of the risk out. So with Henry Boot, they do, as I said, they are carrying that debt, about £80 million. But you get the discount to NAV, and they're still highly profitable. So, it's not a sector that I talk about regularly, but occasionally I see something that say, "Hey, this looks okay," and I think Henry Boot probably does look quite interesting here.
Yeah, I mean, trading at less than sort of like, you know, a discount to net assets of over like 30%, it does look extremely cheap. But you're right, you'd probably have to dig through it exactly to find out whether is that cheap for a reason or is that cheap, is it an opportunity there? But I'd certainly, with a bit of M&A in the sector, then anybody with a sound balance sheet would probably just eat them up very quickly at a decent price and, you know, take them out at tangible book or whatever. So a nice quick return. All right, let's move to a payment provider, but not on one of these online ones. This is the real McCoy. This is the PayPoint. Which does, I think it does the sort of the ATM machines or whatever, not the, but effectively you can get cash out in the shops and stuff. Do you want to take us through this one? Because I would have thought with digitalization of payments, it's a bit of a melting iceberg. I'd be interested in what your thoughts on the growth prospects in this business.
Yeah, I mean, look, I know that I annoy people with this one.
Do you? Okay, sorry. Just for asking.
Yeah, I always annoy people with this one because what I do is I call it a fintech. You know, people hate that. You know, but I do think let me make the argument, right? When you walk into a convenience store and you buy something and they've got a machine there that takes the payment, how can that not be described as a financial technology, which is fintech, right? So it's they've got these convenience store cash machine terminals, point of sale, whatever you want to call them. Yeah. They've got that market totally locked down. And when I, you know, when I'm looking at businesses, one of the things I'm always interested in is this question of, well, is there a competitive advantage, or is there some kind of a monopoly going on here? And you know, the convenience store sort of union, if you like, has occasionally complained that PayPoint is charging too much, you know. And whenever you hear that, well, then that sort of says to me, oh, wow, this must be a company with quite a lot of power. Obviously, that is only one arm of the business. They also bought Appreciate. I don't know. You yeah. probably study that one as well, Paul, a lot. It's kind of in your
love
neck of the
shop,
woods as
isn't
well.
It?
Love to shop. Yeah, exactly. It's the old Parks hamper yeah. business as well, Christmas hampers. Now, this Appreciate business, I feel, was very interesting because I was wondering, well, what synergies could there possibly be? Well, actually, it seems as if they're really working on it quite a lot, and they even want to rejuvenate the Christmas savings side. So, yeah, it's basically PayPoint. It's a mixed bag. There's a lot of different services in there. You know, they've got stuff going on with, you know, your online retailers, click and collect in news agents, paying your bills in the news agent. All the basic idea is that it's providing payment services for people, you know, and other convenient services for people going into convenience stores, like gift vouchers now as well, which yeah. from Appreciate, which they're hopefully going to reboot. So yeah, I remain a fan of this one. It's always had very nice quality metrics, great profitability, pay yeah. a big yield, huge dividend actually.
Yeah,
is it going to grow? Yeah. So now, is that dividend vulnerable? Is it going to grow? Well, look, if they put their profits into things like the Appreciate acquisition, you know, if they did an acquisition like that every couple of years, maybe they'd sort of buy their growth that way. I don't know. I mean, I admit that the core business is not like it's not going to be the next Tesla or something. Okay,
really?
the core business is as low growth as you can probably imagine, but it seems to have a strong competitive position.
So I think if they can put in new products which you know, going to be delighting or attracting customers through the same infrastructure. And I don't know whether that is taking some of the post office services or some of the government services in terms of, you know, benefits and this sort of stuff. If they can start issuing money to people who do that, then it means other things can close and it saves the whole country some cost saving benefits and becomes a, you know, a government backed service. So you're right. There's definitely upside if they can make that sell. But whilst you wait, you've got an 8% dividend yield. So it is a bit of a monster when it comes to income payments. Okay, well, now on the other side of the spectrum, we've got Trustpilot, which is really, this is the Tesla, I guess. It's sort of like on a 4.5x or near enough EV sales multiple. It's got lots of money on the balance sheet, around about 10%. It's done very well, hasn't it? Do you want to take us through this one? Because obviously it's a consumer website that allows people to put sort of like, you know, their views about certain brands and whether they like them or not.
Yeah, thanks. This one, you know, my co-writer Paul Scott, who you know well, he asked me if I was feeling okay or if perhaps perhaps I'd been kidnapped and somebody else was writing the report, because this one was trading at a PE multiple of 200x or something, yep. And in fact, it doesn't really seem to have made much profit at all in the past, so. Yes, ask me what has happened to poor Graham. Well, I think the thing is that you can be a value investor, but you can also keep your eyes and your ears open for other types of investments. And you know, Trustpilot You see, I use Trustpilot myself, and the thing is, most people do probably, even if they may not think about it very much, but they actually do look up Trustpilot. It maybe not every day, but a couple of times a year for something or other. So when you think about the review space, who do you trust? If I, you know, if I can use that word, who do you trust when you look for a review of a business? You know, I was saying, well, there's this, there's Google reviews. Now I'm a shareholder in Alphabet myself, so I would love it if Google reviews was amazing, but it's not really. Google reviews is not that good. You know, so most people will be looking for Trustpilot for the reviews. So I think in terms of market positioning here, there's virtually nothing. There's nothing else apart from Trustpilot. And so, yeah, that's kind of the first thing that I noticed. Then I noticed that they had this big cash pile. And then I noticed that they were actually very close to break even. And, you know, they've surpassed my expectations by sort of flexing their cost base a little bit and just, you know, beating those estimates that were there before. And then they said, well, actually, and this is something they hinted at, what they said at some point late last year, they said, you know, since we have, you know, all this cash and we're not losing cash anymore, we're going to have to think about what we do with the cash. And then, you know, in January, they announced a £20 million share buyback. Now, that's not really huge compared to the market cap. It's only going to take out, you know, a few percent of the shares. But, you know, it's a sign that the company, you know, is cash positive now. And that they can, you know, I think it's interesting as well, the fact that they chose to do that rather than pay a dividend, you know, especially in the UK, you expect, you know, a lot of, you know, it's a sort of a stereotype, but a lot of UK investors just want the dividend and they kind of don't really, you know, they're not really impressed that much by a share buyback. But Trustpilot said, no, we're just going to do a share buyback. We're not paying any dividend out of this money that we're making. And, you know, so we've got very strong revenue growth, you know, 17-18%. And if you value the company as a multiple of its annualized recurring revenue, you get a number which I think in an American context would look quite modest. You know, the typical software company in America, you know, would trade at maybe, it changes every year, but let's say
10, 15 times.
Sales. Well, it could be. Yeah. I mean, I think it came off a bit over the last year, but certainly if you had 7 or 10 as an answer, you'd say, well, that's decent value. And then you look at Trustpilot and it's trading at, I don't know, maybe 6 times.
Four and a half times, yeah.
Have you got on 4.5 times now?
Four and a half times, yeah. I mean, I would say you raise a really good point there because you haven't got to even go to the state. Just look at Rightmove, and I haven't checked what the EV sales is there, but it traditionally used to be anywhere between sort of like 10 and 20 times sales. And if you do become a dominant trophy asset in sort of like, you know, this whole space, which it does seem as though it's coming, then yeah, you're right, it's cheap, I guess.
Yeah, actually I'm a Rightmove shareholder as well, I should disclose, but I don't own Trustpilot currently, to my detriment. But yeah, I mean, Rightmove is similar idea, where it's 90% plus market share or whatever. I mean, Trustpilot could be effectively 100% market share. I mean, depending on how you want to measure it, or, you know, if who you think its competitors are, I don't really see any competition.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to another one, consumer one. We've got IG Designs, which sort of manufactures and distributes sort of Christmas wrapping paper and other celebrations sort of stuff around the world. Makes 5% EBIT margins, not quite what most of the sort of the NEARI portfolio makes. But what sort of attracts you there? Because it's obviously got a lot of seasonality. And I would sort of like just ask, you know, sort of, what's the USP of it? Scale, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've done a bit of soul searching around this one because, you know, in my heart of hearts, I know that it's not really a high quality business. You know, it's not, you know, it's producing stuff that is in many ways commoditized, I would argue. You know, celebrations and I don't know, Christmas crackers and wrapping and all this stuff is it is commoditized. So yeah, this wouldn't be on my, you know, if I had a list of quality shares and value shares, this would definitely be in the value idea. But yeah, my basic idea here was just the idea of recovery, a bit like the soft drinks makers, the soft drinks companies. You have this sort of COVID-related inflationary problem where costs are rising and customers aren't quite catching up in terms of paying those prices. So yeah, I was just basically saying to myself, well, maybe this one can go back because, you know, if you go back pre-COVID, you know, IG was, you know, it was highly profitable. It was an impressive business. And, you know, they've had, you know, they've done a lot of work on their balance sheet. They're just looking at the estimates there. They're looking at cash is around $75 million now. So they've, you know, the balance sheet seems pretty good. You know, they're diversified between here and the United States. So yeah, I just think as a recovery play, it could be interesting. I think they if you saw inflation getting properly passed through to customers paying for these commoditized products, you'd get a nice uplift on profitability. You know, operating margin used to be around 5%. You know, a clean operating margin of 5%.
Okay, good. Well, let's move to another one. ME Group, which did you was the old photo ME business, but seems to have really sort of transformed itself into sort of like, you know, upskilled the photo booths with digital photos and stuff, and also does similar sort of technology for launderettes, I think, as well, sort of like its own sort of DIY launderette. Or what's your sort of what's attracted you to this? Because the shares, I think, have done quite well, actually.
Yeah, I just thought I'd throw this into the mix for today's discussion. A bit like IG Design, it's not, you know, it's not one that's made my best ideas list. But, you know, I'm, you know, even now, like around here, I'm seeing these revolution laundry services all over the place, everywhere I go. And even their little, you know, their little kids' rides, you know, little things to, so you put a few quid in and you know
Yeah, I
distracts the
remember the little
children for a few
ladybird
minutes.
things, yeah.
So and then obviously the photo booth business. So look, this one, as you know, this one's been knocking around for a long time, but currently trading at a P multiple of about
10,
nine or 10
I've got, yeah,
times.
10, 5% dividend yield, and it does 22% EBIT margins. It looks very much a bit like the one we talked, PayPoint. You know, it's high margins and really dominant position in the, nobody else can get into the market.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it does generate these really high returns. And yeah, as you say, in the photo booth market, and actually, even though it's relatively new, you could say in the laundromat market as well, it's kind of taken this position where, if you know, you almost expect to see it. You know, if you go into a shopping center, you'd be surprised if it wasn't one of their machines. Or one of their laundry machines. So, yeah, I think, you know, maybe there's something to be said for the scale that they've achieved in both of those key core services where there isn't really anybody else, you know, trying to compete with them at this point. And maybe it's going to be a nice, solid, steady business from now on. Obviously, there's always this talk about passports and whether people will take their own passports, but I don't know, it seems to be surprisingly resilient. I mean, I would have thought if photo booth demand was going to fall off, surely it would have done it by now.
Yeah, I agree. And it's got a good solid balance sheet as well. Plays, as I say, a 5% dividend yield. What's not to like, really? So, yeah. Okay, last one on the consumer one is I know it's quite controversial between you and Paul, is Supreme, which basically is an FMCG products company, mainly sort of like vaping devices, but also does lighting and batteries and other those and sports and wellness, I think. And the government, as the people probably know, has just said it's going to be banning the disposable vaping devices. And one of its competitors, Chill Brands, went down by 30% on the day. And then you called it right in the morning. You said stick with it, and the shares went up by 10%. So well done there. What's sort of your latest on Supreme? Because it still trades at a ludicrous sort of 6 times PE and 4% dividend yield and no debt, basically, or very little debt.
Yeah, well, I think the point here is that Supreme has been bracing for news on the vaping front for a while. I mean, basically for a year at least, they've been expecting something to happen and they've been preparing for it. And so for example, the news around flavors, like that was something that Supreme had already taken stock of. Now the question is, can they, how much of a hit is it? I think it is a significant hit to ban disposable vapes. I calculated that it could be up to a third of revenues that would be affected. So definitely a big, issue. But there's a lot of mitigating issues here, mitigating factors. So for a start, Supreme makes non-disposable vapes. So why would people not just switch to that, for example? The legislation itself may have some issues in terms of how exactly do you define a disposable versus a non-disposable vape. So there may be loopholes which the government will no doubt be trying to exclude, but it may be difficult to exclude those loopholes. And so basically, I think that Supreme has time to prepare for this. It will take the best part of 2 years probably before the legislation actually has any impact. And over that time, it can work on its non-disposable vapes. So, so overall there, I don't think that it is, such terrible news. And, you already mentioned the valuation. Surely we can make an argument, it may not be correct, that it was priced in already. Yeah, and obviously, Supreme doesn't just do vapes. They do other things,
Sports and
batteries
wellness and batteries and
and
lighting, yeah.
lighting. Yeah, so there's other pieces of the pie there. But it was a remarkably robust response that they made, saying we're going to buy back our shares. I think a lot of the times when companies do that, they're just doing it to sort of give the market a sign. It does not really, the 1 million pound share buyback is not going to move the needle here. But Supreme is basically just telling everybody we're not worried. And as I expressed, I think it was priced in.
Yeah, I would agree, and I think also in terms of that move about banning disposable vapes, if you're an adult and you're sort of vaping, then is there much difference between using a disposable or using a refillable? And the answer to that is probably not. So you just move on. And we've got a movie on this one before because you look at the classic razor blade model. We had disposable razors with the big ones for years, as my, and then we moved on to the replacing with a blade. And has it meant that the industry is any less profitable? It certainly doesn't seem to be to me, that's for sure, when you look at Gillette's margins.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go to the last one then. We've got sort of quite a sort of like a, an economically sensitive stock, S3, which does sort of like STEM recruitment for large companies, and STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math, sort of like recruiting, got a rocks another one of the classic Neary. He's got a rock solid balance sheet, lots of cash, 80 odd million, trades at 11 times PE on relatively trough earnings, plays near 4% dividend yield. Could you take us through this one? You know, I'm guessing it looks too cheap.
Yeah, look, I've been covering this one for a while, but it's kind of a strange one because I don't really cover many recruitment stocks. You know, I think a lot of recruitment businesses are probably, you know, very good businesses in their own right, if you're working for them or if you're a customer or whatever. But as an investment, I would say a lot of recruitment businesses are quite bad because they're so labor intensive and it's just a people business and there's no franchise, there's no intellectual property and so on. I could go on all day. But the difference with S3 is it stands out as being highly focused on STEM, you know, clue in the ticker, STEM, highly focused and extraordinarily productive and generating good returns over many years for investors. And what they've done is they made this strategic decision to kind of move away from permanent recruitment. So, I mean, maybe we can make an analogy that it's like the difference between being an estate agent who does sales or an estate agent who does lettings.
Yeah.
You know, they've moved to this contract recruitment model where they are helping people get contract jobs. And obviously, when you do that, it's not just a one-time hit because, you know, the person will have a new contract, you know, a couple of years later. So contract is making it a higher quality business. And because they're focused on, you know, science, technology and programming and so on, they're, you know, these are highly, you know, really good jobs, really good contracts that they're working on. And yeah, I just think if I had to pick as any recruiter, it would have to be this one.
Yeah, I would agree. And it's got real recession downside resilience there because with so much cash on the balance sheet and with that sort of, that STEM focus, no doubt about it. Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Graham, for your excellent insights. If anybody wants to use your services, whether it's in Stockopedia or elsewhere, how best to do that?
Follow me on Twitter, Graham Neary, that's my name, and take it from there.
Brilliant. Okay, well, look forward in touching base in 6 months' time. So thanks very much, Graham.
Thanks, Paul. A pleasure.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.